your crush?
Thanks for coming back, Jay.
Happy to be back.
Okay.
Definitely hot outside.
Yeah, it's definitely hot. It is about 1,000 degrees outside, and but we are here to talk about some very interesting things. You went to see a guy named Barnsley. Okay, so let's talk about Barnsley. Who's Barnsley? How do you know about Barnsley? How did this happen?
There's this guy in London named Barnsley that's been in the streetwear high fashion. He's been around in the culture since the 80s. And I never met him until February. And I living in Japan for 6 years, you hear a lot about him. So you meet people, tells you the London story, and the name Barnsley pops up. And sometimes it's very positive, sometimes it's very negative, but it's always interesting. And I became fascinated by that guy, Barnsley, and all the story and the people that have, you know, interaction with him in the past. And it's always mad story, always end up late night.
Right.
And
it, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like what he's kind of known for in a bigger sense is that he sort of co-opted fashion brands and put them on t-shirts, like the Chanel shirts and all that kind of stuff. Like,
yeah, I mean, I heard once in Japan that he was responsible, someone told me that he was responsible for the smiley t-shirt.
Right.
You know, it's like
the happy face.
Yeah, it's like
the yellow happy face thing, yeah.
So, true or not, it's funny that someone claimed that Barnsley invented the happy face t-shirt, and he was part of the original Stussy tribe from London, and his relationship with Sean Stussy and Hiroshi back in late 80s. And I mean, the evolution of this guy in the industry, in music, fashion, and his impact he had in Tokyo, London, and the amount of people that he interacted with the last 4 years almost, it's amazing. So he's kind of created himself like a legend, urban legend, that is very, very undocumented on the internet. And that's what I always find it fascinating, is like, I keep hearing from people I respect, people I love, great story about that guy. But if I type his name on Google, there's almost nothing.
Right.
And part of it because most of the story and the content he created are in people's memories and they're undocumented. It's like he never do press release for the things that he does.
Right.
It just happened. And if you dare to witness it, it's amazing. If you're not, your only way to know about it is someone else telling you.
He's a word of mouth mythological creature.
Exactly. Exactly. So when I went to London, I was like, okay, who can I interview there first for this first chapter of my new resolution? And I talked to my friend Craig Ford. I had a number of names with whom I'm involved in a date to the operation of like Bedouin Heartbreakers and Kinfolk. And I asked him, do you happen to know Barnsley? I heard
what's
so much.
What's Bedouin?
Bedouin Heartbreakers is a Japanese brand that I've been helping for 7 years or
oh,
so.
Oh, okay.
That I started Kinfolk, and so they're part of the extended family. And Craig Ford represents Bedouin and also Kinfolk in London.
Okay.
So, and Craig was like, yeah, I know Barnsley. He's a great friend of mine. I can set you up with an interview. And that's how it started. And the interview that I did of Barnsley that afternoon, it was a rainy Friday afternoon, and it was in Craig's office in Shoreditch in London.
Right. And it was a pretty, I mean, I listened to the recording, and it's pretty funny. I mean, he's pretty funny. So you talked about a lot of things, and it's in what I thought also was interesting is that a lot of the things you guys wound up talking about are a lot of the things that we talk about, especially here in the Culture Crush office, but then that you and I talk about a lot. Things like, you know, you talked about a lot about the relationship at one time between the pop music world and and how it influenced fashion, and in a way that it doesn't anymore. And the way that he puts it is really interesting.
I guess, you know, pop music's got a lot to answer for the whole, informing the whole of culture, really, hasn't it? Do you know what I mean? I mean, I guess it's yourself, most of your references that you would get into as a designer would probably be from music a lot of the time, wouldn't they? Do you know what I mean? You can't quite describe that, though, can you? How you can listen to a record and all of a sudden you can make a sketch of a piece of clothing.
Yeah.
And it's you can't quite understand why that happened, but, you know, I was just inspired to make those clothes because of that
music. Of course.
Music.
Of course.
You know, and I think, I mean, most people I know who make clothes are exactly the same, actually.
It is so interesting that he talks about the process of being like, just being in tune with what was going on in pop music and how that, and not in the sense that, oh, you saw so-and-so was wearing a t-shirt, so you want to design stuff that looks like what they're wearing. Yeah. That's not what he meant. He meant the music. He meant the music and the whole, like the vibe of the music. And you know, it was almost as if, he's actually, you know, you heard him say the words that people would sit down and make a drawing of a dress. And it was somehow, you know, it's very hard to describe how it was influenced by the music, but it was. I mean, even at that, you know, back in the 90s, the last moment of, you know, before everything went so mass and all of the cultures got all mixed up. But also, like, what songs that they played at the shows was a big deal. I mean, Jeremy Healy, who's another, you know, he's a friend of the house, and we definitely need to get him on the show. He was, you know, the guy that designed the music for some of the greatest shows. He worked really closely with John Galliano. And John Galliano's, you know, first shows, even his first shows for Dior, it wasn't just about, you know, he broke so many rules in terms of, like, the set design and taking the girls off the catwalks and all that kind of stuff and making these worlds and these dreams. But also the music that they had at those shows, the way it was mixed and da-da. And I once interviewed Jeremy for French Vogue about that. And, you know, what he said was, and I interviewed John also, about how they worked together. And even that when the girls would come for their fittings, you know, in those days, even like Linda Evangelista and Naomi Campbell would like come for their fitting because each dress was, you know, just made for them. And what they would also do is they would play them the piece of music that they were that was going to be on when they went down the catwalk, so that they could like get into it and know what their music moment was going to be. And John actually told a story that at one point it was one of the big, most famous shows, and Linda was, she was, they were like, go, like she was supposed to step out on the runway, and she was like, it's not my time, it's not my music yet, I, you know, it's all of a sudden there was this big hole in the whole
music
show.
Music was a cue.
Because, she was just like, I only want to, like, I was thinking about, like, that, walking to that music the whole time, I can't, like, I have to wait for my music. So, yeah, so there was that tie then that just isn't around anymore.
Music was definitely the connector between culture back then. And the club, the nightclub, was what the internet is right now. It's like,
right,
you go to the club. I love when Barnsley talk about going to the club and seeing someone that's better style than you.
Right.
And then you go back the Saturday after and like you get inspired and you want to top that guy. And then it's all about a competition. And it's like, it's social. It's a social place, a place of encounter. And is all happening through music.
You know, there was no internet. So nobody's been informed where anything's coming from. Literally, your local sort of like internet thing would be nightclubs. You'd have to go to a club and see what everybody's wearing. Oh, fucking EI's got one of them, you know, whoever's really sharp enough to hang on a minute. Oh, fucking, that geezer's got a nice shirt and that geezer's got like a nice fucking pair of trousers on. Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then try and put it together next week so you've got like a whole thing like, bunch of cunts, like, and then some other cunt will copy you and do it better, and then so, you know, then, you know, it's like, we like that, really, yeah.
And it's funny, fashion, it's, at that time, a lot of the, I think the creator in high fashion were part of that scene, but they were not necessarily giving back to that scene in terms of product, and I think now, they sort of been more mixed between high fashion and street, there's much more dialogue in between both, I think, than before.
Right.
At least in demo product also. When Barnsley is saying in the interview that the first time someone was like, oh, you're into fashion? And he was like, what?
Right.
He's like, I thought fashion was for old ladies.
Right, exactly.
And now none of the kids that listen to us or our friends that are younger than 25 will think that being into fashion is something for old lady, you know?
Yeah,
that's
now it's also become very unisex. It used to always also only be like, oh, only girls are into that. And now it's like, you meet guys all the time who are like talking to me about like Lanvin menswear and what do I think? I'm like, really? Like, I like businessmen, that were buying suits and stuff. Mm. It used to be that like, you either like went to Savile Row or not, you know? Then you weren't like, or you went to Brooks Brothers or whatever.
Yeah.
You definitely weren't into like knowing names but yeah, now the fashion brands have become, they're just celebrity brands like everything else.
And the designer,
right?
Rockstar. When before Rockstar used to influence designer, now they're like almost in the same level.
But let's get back to that, because that is a really interesting idea that he talked about the going to the clubs.
Mm.
And yeah, that's we heard him say that you would just look around and then see what other people were wearing and then like try to come up with your own version and sort of like outdo them and then like next week show up and then like you were wearing like the cooler outfit and but that goes okay. So as I said at the beginning, it's like I start to notice when I hear the same thing over and over again. It was like when we were talking with Ryan and Keith from Kinfolk. And Ryan was saying that now the most counterculture people that he knows actually just look like, they wear cargo shorts and golf hats, and you would never know. Whereas there used to be like a uniform of the counterculture, there always was historically, whether it was like a leather jacket or whatever, and now there isn't any. And that so what does that say about street? So what happens to streetwear when that happens?
The funny thing is like now clothing and personal style doesn't tell you surrounding anything about what you stand for culturally.
Right.
People dress in a hip hop way, but they listen to rock and roll, or now it's all a facade in a way. It's all purely aesthetic. When before it's like if you dress punk in London in the 80s, you better be listening to punk music and be involved with the scene. If not, you'll be someone is gonna call you out. And same with hip hop. And now they are thinking like the way you dress is one thing, and it's purely aesthetic. And where you taste lie and where you enjoy your day off has nothing to do with the way you dress. And this is funny, and that's kind of thing that's linked back to the real agent and people that participate to real counterculture now. They dress very normal because they don't want the outfit to talk about who they are. They want a black t-shirt or a white t-shirt, a denim, and a pair of sneakers that is not on trend. And they want their walk or they want their passion to talk about who they are, not their clothing.
Right.
So I find that quite interesting.
Right, until that becomes the new uniform.
Yeah.
Right? People will be like, what's that t-shirt? Oh, it must be Hermes. No, something like that. Let's get back into Barnsley. So what was the experience like? So you loved meeting him. It must have been so fun. I mean, he's so funny.
I
found it so funny too that every time you asked him a question, he would say, no, that's not it at all. But then he kind of would agree with you.
Yeah.
Like, but he always started off with like, no, not at all.
Yeah.
You were like, oh, so did you come to London because of this? And he's like, no. But then he actually, he did, that was really funny. He just was like sort of in denial about like who he was. I thought that was very, in a very charming way. That was very, very charming. But
he's a very charming guy. And for me, I was enjoying listening to him talk so much that I almost like wish I could have a second shot at interviewing him, less as a spectator or a fan, but more with like more question. And I think he's a funny guy, and I always respect people that follow their heart, even when they, you know, end up losing a lot of time. For me, it's kind of like the Diego Maradona of the culture that I'm involved with, the street culture. It's like, there's obviously a tremendous amount of talent, but there's also like a self-destructive kind of, you know, aspect to the guy. And I mean, I admire that, because at the end, he creates, his legacy is going to be more than most of the people I know in that industry, but you won't find it on Google.
Right.
So yeah, there's a human factor that I find fascinating in him. I work with a lot of younger men and women, and they're fascinated by our generation as much as we fascinated by their generation.
Right.
It's like just it's a different set of values, and as we were fascinated, we were like obsessed with non-tangible principle, like not being a sellout.
Right.
And as you say, most of the time, if you look back at it, it was to our detriment, at least sometime in our career or economically. But we will never change that for all the gold in the world, because that's what kind of defines us. And then their value is based on economical success and constant progress in life.
Right.
And being a sellout is not even a thing, because you always need to do better. And buying a house at 29 from stuff that you created is more important than a body of work that is authentic and
right.
You know, and I think it's also maybe based on the fact that we come from a era where there was no that much of unemployment. Life was we had time to not be a sellout. I think we had time to experience. We had time to be authentic, and to be broke for a few years and to do our things until we, in our 30s or in our 40s, we're slowly gonna make it, because
and then sell out, yeah.
Yeah, and sell out, you know. I think those the kids these days,
they can't afford to not sell out,
no,
what you're saying.
I think the pressure on them from like being a teenager, they need to make it. They have no time to go explore the world and be authentic for a few years. And because they're gonna come back, after that they're gonna come back to a world ultra competitive with 10% unemployment, especially in creative field.
Right.
So they're scared. So
yeah,
they
they'll
you know
be 3 years behind everybody else.
Yeah. So they you know they
well that's something that you actually that Barnsley talked about, that you guys talked about together. When you asked him you know, if he felt like there was this kind of creative, you know, thing going on because of the fact that in the 80s in the UK, they had this very sort of very conservative regime, you know, and with the Thatcher and all of that. And, you know, of course his answer to it was no. But then I think that, yeah, he said that at that time, like, young people weren't thinking about what their career was going to be,
yeah,
or even like, yeah, like what area, like what cool area you were going to live in. And he tells the story of that, like, yeah, you just had a friend, you had a flat, and then you got the keys, and then you just sort of stayed there. And
I mean, I don't really know, actually. It was weird, though, because, you know, I think nowadays everybody's very more yuppified. In them days, nobody really concerned about having a job and what you're going to do with the future and what you're going to, where you're going to work and how you're going to eat and where you're going to live. People used to live in squats, you know. Literally, there used to be this, like, hippie estate agent guy, right? I went to this one place in, like, Elephant and Castle. I went around to my mate's house. He had this, like, you know, all the big council, which used to be, like, punk rocker squats. I'd go into one of them and, you know, they were all a bit weird, new romantics, and go be like a rockabilly, you know, they were all that was the equivalent of all the trendy things then. Oh, do you need a flat? They'd be like, you know, it's crashed at my mate's for it. Oh, you need to get your own place. Oh, right. Cool. Well, come and see. What's his name? I can't remember his name. Fucking Nigel, I think it was called.
Yeah.
Right? Go around and see him around the corner, yeah? So he'd go around and see this fucking hippie guy, right? And he'd be like, yeah, all right, come with me. And this guy, like, you know, hang on, went off, smoked a bit of pot or something. And you get to this big block of flats, you know, you go in there, and he'd be like, right, hang on, I'm getting the right, you know, give us a fiver.
Yeah.
And he'd just give you the key, you know, and then that's it. You could just live there for as long as you wanted, you know, until you got bored, you know, move on, you know. Some chick would move in and take over the flat, and then you'd have to leave, and, you know, stuff like that. And it was quite good, you know.
Yeah.
And then there was always somebody cooking food, you know, and everybody would bunk into concerts.
Yeah.
You know, nobody ever paid in it, ever, you know, to gigs. Everybody was always on a guest list everywhere, you know.
But, you know, but I think that that is, you know, it's exactly what you're saying. That, you know, maybe we had a, you know, also, like, look at the world now. We were also, it was a time where there was no, there were no wars going on. There were no, we were, like, constantly in this sort of tragedy mode, uncertainty. Mm-mm. I guess we were, we had a very stable sort of background in which to, we could be slackers and we could be, you know, like, no, I'm just going to do, you know, all of this stuff, by the way, that we're referring to all comes from Douglas Copeland's book, Generation X. So we're, I've been digging into it, and I mean, he couldn't have, everything in that book was just, he was so right about everything, because it was almost, what's interesting to go back and read it now is that, well, first of all, he's talking about us. He's talking about us when we were in our early 20s. So that's really jarring because, you know, we're talking about like stupid 21-year-olds, but it was us as stupid 21-year-olds, you know? So, and people didn't understand us either the way we're like, we don't, how can millennials think that way, you know? But, you know, he, the, all of the predictions started with this, the, a malaise that with the over marketing and the, you know, he came up with that phrase, I am not a target market, you know, all that, you know, the over marketing, the over branding, like, I guess that was just beginning, not anything close to how it is now. But it was beginnings of that. And we were reacting against the, you know, in the 80s sort of yuppie culture, the over consumerism, greed is good, Wall Street, all that kind of stuff. Big hair, big jewelry, you know, Donald Trump, which now is back in our lives, bigger and better than ever. but, you know, yeah, there was, so we were sort of reacting against that, but I think, you know, I think you just made an incredible point that maybe we had the luxury to behave that way.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Especially, I think we are the... we are shaped by the mistake and the flaws of the generation before us. And I don't know if the millennials are a reaction directly to us, but they're a reaction to the late baby boomers, maybe, that kind of destroyed the world, the Western world. That's my personal opinion. And they left a world for the millennials is much more competitive, what is unemployment, HIV, all the things that the generation 69 did in the 70s, the millennium are kind of paying for it now, and they live in that world. So that's why I'm, you know, I'm with them. It's tough out there.
We have to be, we have to be with them, because as Keith points out, Keith of Kim Folk, points out that, that, you know, they're also, the boomers are now starting to sort of move out, and we're the ones moving into the positions of power. So now millennials kind of have to deal with us. So we're having more of a an interaction with them, let's say. But yeah, I guess they were, yeah, they were dealing with the sort of like boomer mentalities, and you're right, they really left a shitty world behind. But now, and I guess what we're saying is that now it's up to us. All right, so let's talk about, so what are we gonna do? First, our next thing that's coming out together is this story that we've been working on about this topic, about this Generation X, millennials, boomers, and this sort of generational thing. And it's a really nice conversation between the Culture Crush and the Kinfolk guys. So I'm really excited for that to come out. And then, of course, what are we the most excited for is the new issue of the Culture Crush, which we are now beginning to work on a little bit, and the stories are starting to shape and form, and this is kind of how we do it over a series of months, so that, you know, the stories are a little bit more in depth, and so Jay, you're going to be working on something which I'm really excited about, so tell us about that story.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of exciting story for the next issue, definitely. And one aspect of one story that I would like to share with the Culture Crash in the next issue is a personal project that I'm going to be directing in Beirut, Lebanon. And that's kind of also part of that resolution I had earlier this year about telling story about things that fascinate me. And I've always been fascinated by the city of Beirut. I'd never been, which is exciting and scary at the same time. But I've always been fascinated by a small town at the end. It's like a couple of million people maximum. And there's a small town by the Mediterranean that has a very very religious southern suburb with the neighborhood where the Hezbollah as is headquarters, basically, where everybody's like Shia Muslim and live life according to their religion. And is also Beirut is also the hub for nightlife and party in the Middle East. So you have all those rich Arabs from Dubai, from Riyadh, going to Beirut to party and be wild. And how those two worlds coexist in such a small town? And you add to that a million plus Syrian refugee. I think that creates a kind of a stew, a soup that is like an amazing human experience story. And we know with everything that's happening right now in France, in the US, with the Muslim world, I think it would be interesting for people like me and my friends to go out there and try to find some positive story to tell about the Muslim world. And the take that we want to pursue is youth culture in a city like Beirut. How is it to be young and party in Beirut? How is it to be young and just being a young Muslim in South Beirut, you know, how's life? And, you know, hopefully we'll see there's not too much difference between them and us.
Right,
you know?
Right. Well, tell us about the artists that you're going with.
So I'm going with Georgie Esparza, great friend of mine and talented photographer and artist. And I know he's going to capture the rawness of the city better than
Does
anyone.
Does he have any connection to Beirut, or he just also
no.
is like, oh, that's...
He's from here. He's been active in New York for like a decade, and he's a... I don't want him to know much about Beirut. I want him to... He has a pure eye, and I want him to... I'll do most of the... I'll create situation, and I want him to experience them, and give us his take on it. So the fact that he has a very, it's like a blank canvas for him,
mm-hmm.
he doesn't know much
yeah.
about it. I'm excited about that part because
yeah,
he's gonna react like very purely and spontaneously to situation.
Right.
And he understands youth better than anyone. So I'm excited about that. We'll be in Beirut for 2 weeks and yeah, we'll bring back some amazing content, I hope.
I hope so too. No, it's going to be, like, I feel like just in, and not on purpose, but I feel like the next issue is going to be stories from all around the world, which is exciting. And again, you know, my hopes and dreams for the next issue are, you know, it's a really tough and, it's a difficult moment in the world, let's say, that I think a lot of people are having. And, in our Gen X way, what we do here at the Culture Crush, we do because we just, you know, there are beautiful things all around the world. And it's good to focus on those things, too, sometimes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so let's end it right there before I get too emotional. And, so thanks for coming by again. I hope that you're a regular visitor here in the studio. And all right, so I can't wait to see what you come back with from Beirut, and I'll see you in the fall.
I'm okay. excited to come back and always share a good story here.
Great, thanks, Jay.
You're welcome.